Blog Talk Radio.
Forbidden archaeology, forgotten history, divination, magic, cryptozoology, UFOs, nature, science, and spirit. All this and more right here on the Main Street Universe Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Main Street Universe. I am your host and co-founder, co-creator of the Main Street Universe Network, Mr. Daniel Michael. And with me this evening is, of course, as every Wednesday, Miss Janice R. White.
How you doing, everybody?
And also joining us all the way from the fighting city of whichever town in Michigan he's from, Mr. Brett Hillman. Hello, Brett.
Glad to be here.
Hello, Brett.
And I hope you're feeling better. We'll start everybody getting our heads together as to what your possible thing is going on there. And I know it's been a very strange week for a lot of people. There's all
very
kinds
strange
of
week.
Strange stories going around everywhere. So I'm not even going to get into that right now. But I want to remind everybody that Main Street Universe is a network of now 6 shows, so we're on the air 6 nights a week, basically, as we started once from an 11 a.m. Wednesday morning show, myself and Kevin Barrett, but now we have, of course, this evening, Main Street Universe, Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, all these are Eastern, then Thursday, tomorrow at 1 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, is Queen Mother Imaku. And she has just joined us recently, the last few weeks, after doing an episode of Main Street Universe with us. And it's great to have her on board for her interesting perspective with the Kemetic African tradition that she's an expert in. And then, of course, at Friday evenings, technically Saturday, but it's Friday evenings at midnight, is Jesse Ann Nichols George and Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour. Jesse is the author of 2 books, going on 4. She'll be finishing the other 2 soon. And Jesse has been with us now probably about 3/4 of a year, I think, or so, something like that. Which reminds me, today is very close to Denise's 1-year anniversary here.
1 year, guys. And they said it wouldn't that last.
Who was they?
Many, trust me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really? I didn't know that. It's nice to know you have a reputation out there, doesn't it? And, of course, Brett has been with us since just about the beginning, the first or second or third episode we started. So there's more people getting involved. Anyway, back to the schedule Jesse's is Friday at midnight, Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour. Lots of good, interesting guests, some life coaching. She's had some interesting pet rescue charities and all sorts of different guests that she's had, including the New Age musician a little while back, Steve Halpern.
Oh, yeah, that was a great show, actually.
So we've had some really great guests. And now, of course, on Sundays, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, is Darren Bouquer. And Darren Bouquer is a palm reader as well as a tarot reader and spiritual consultant who works at Marie Laveau's House of Voodoo in the magical city of New Orleans. So Darren has joined us, and he's our Sunday evening host, and I usually join him for a little bit on that show as well. And he also discusses topics. He opens the lines for readings, but he discusses some of his training and different techniques. Now, also, of course, Mondays is Kevin Baird, the co-founder of the Main Street Universe Radio Network, and Kevin's show is called Walking on the Sidewalk, Horizon Oracle's Journey, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And today, our guest is T. Thorne Coyle, an author, musician, activist, all sorts of things going on there, and she's definitely got some history that I'm a little bit interested in. Of course, we'll get to all that during the interview. And I'm going to go ahead, and as I say, instead of me talking about her, we will have her talk about her. And your microphone is on now. T. Thorne Coyle, welcome to Main Street Universe.
Welcome, T.
Hi, many blessings. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being a guest. And I'm going to start off the questions. Now, I don't know if you remember, but I first met you briefly in Sacred Space 2010, if I believe. Mm-hmm. Then I got to meet you all over again when you were in Baltimore at Bree Books, mm-hmm. where you had introduced your new book, Make Magic a Part of Your Life. So my questions are going to be from that book, while Daniel and Brett are going to ask questions of your own.
Right.
But my first question is, what was your motivation to create this book, Make Magic a Part of Your Life?
Well, I started writing Make Magic of Your Life as a series of blog posts because I found that my students and spiritual direction clients were having trouble with two things. They were having trouble connecting with desire and passion mm-hmm. in their lives, and feeling fear around following desire or uncovering desire, and also having trouble with the power of manifestation, of following desire towards what they really wanted and towards what I call our divine work in the world is. You know, we each have our divine purpose, the work we're put here to do, and I found that people were really having trouble figuring out how to connect with that. So I started writing a series of blog posts about it, and the response was just enormous. And that's why I wrote the book. And the book is based around Eliphas Levi's Powers of the Sphinx: to know, to will, to dare, and to keep silence. And when we bring all those four things together, we can manifest. And we can be of greater service, and we can really step into what our purpose is.
Yes, the four powers of the Sphinx is normally taught, I guess, in the first Wicca 101 or Metaphysics 101. It's something that everybody draws on or at least thinks about when they're going to manifest magic. So I could see why you wrote a book featuring the four powers of the Sphinx.
Some people call it the Witch's Pyramid.
Yes.
And it's such a vital and powerful set of concepts. And as you said, people often are introduced to it at the very beginning, but then mm-hmm. too often we leave it there and we fail to return to it and figure out that we can go through that cycle at every level of our spiritual development, and that the four powers are really necessary for every phase in our lives. So I really appreciated getting a chance to revisit the four powers and dig more deeply into them.
Yes. Could you share with our audience in a few words your, if you have any special definition of the four powers or the way that you remember them, or is it just fine to just to do, to know, to dare, to will, and keep silent, and to keep silent, sorry.
Well, there's a lot of ways to work with the four powers. I prefer to use them as a process because that's where most of my theology is based. I'm a process theologian, that we're all in process. God herself is in process. The cosmos, the universe is in process. The gods are in process, right? And so if I can follow the ancient dictum to know myself first, if I can even just know a little bit, that starts me off. And as soon as I activate the power to know, then I can step into will. And will, for me, is intention in action.
Okay.
So I know something. I have a concept and a framework. How am I going to set my intention around that and act? And once I do that, I have to open up into the power to dare. And this is often really challenging for many of us, because the power to dare is the power of letting go of what Aleister Crowley called lust of revolt, right?
Okay.
We have to be delivered of lust of result. The Bhagavad Gita says, be intent on action, not on the fruits of action. So that requires daring. It requires us to say, okay, I'm acting, and yet as soon as I act, the cosmos, the universe steps forward in all these interlocking parts, and the future changes.
Okay.
So I can't exactly know the outcome. I've got to trust and let go of the outcome temporarily. And then I need to move into the spaciousness of the power to keep silence, which is the power of integration, the power of digestion, and the power of the greater mystery. And if I can step into that mystery and really allow myself the space of letting the work I've set in motion settle and integrate, then something new has a chance to emerge, and a more complete manifestation comes forward. Whereas if I was trying to control things every step of the way, or if I was not allowing space, that space for mystery to enter, my manifestation wouldn't be as full, and I wouldn't be as effective, right? I'd be trying to micromanage everything, and I'd get stuck in the loop of, you know, no will dare, no will dare. Or sometimes in our overculture, we just go from will to dare, right? And we end up like hamsters. And we never sink in. We never open to a larger purpose and a larger sense of connection with the cosmos and with our divine work. So that's a basic way of working with them. I've also found it very helpful to think of them in terms of the four phases of the sun. So the power to know is that dawning knowledge. It's the dawning of the sun. It's that first emergence. And the power to will is that sun at noon, that sun at full power. And it's us harnessing that power to move forward in action. And then the power to dare is the sun at dusk, at sunset, that liminal space where we're neither day nor night and things are a little less clear. It's that twilight space that's so potent.
Mm-hmm.
That's the power to dare. And then the power to keep silence, of course, is the midnight sun.
Okay.
That space where the sun is hidden and yet it's still present. And so how do we tap into that? So that's another way we can work with the four powers. And I find those very helpful to work with both seasonally and emotionally and in life phases.
Okay. So that was very interesting. So when you said to know if I got this right or if I wrote it right, like the beginning of the sunrise.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. To will, like the midday sun or afternoon sun. To dare, more of the sun setting or evening. And to keep silent, more of the midnight sun. Did I write that down correctly?
Yes.
Okay.
I had a question because you mentioned giving things space and allowing them to breathe and integrate naturally. And because, you know, in modern day practices, you know, people throw around things like The Secret and Law of Attraction and all of this, which are basically, I don't want to get into that now, but kind of the Law of Attraction is kind of an amalgam, I think, of the Hermetic Seven Principles. It's kind of wrapped up into a little burrito. And people will say, you know, constantly think about it, think about your goal. Are you saying kind of let it go for a while, like let it breathe and let it be? Is that was sort of what you were saying?
That's part of it. That's a big part of it. The letting go begins with the power to dare. Because and this is where things like the law of attraction go awry, because we are not the only component in the cosmos, right? There are many other things that as soon as we move, they're going to step forward and meet us. And that helps us create something that's brand new that we couldn't really think of back at the power to know. And so we need to reassess. And the power to keep silence, yes, helps us let go further and helps things to incubate. And that incubation process enables us to change. It enables the work we've set into motion to change. And as I said, it enables us to better meet that which is mysterious, that which is ineffable, so we can actually co-create with the larger cycle rather than just the smaller cycles that are more easily knowable by us. So it's very important to our process to keep silence. And yes, to let go temporarily and to not always be striving. Keeping our goal in mind is helpful, and we can return to our goal, but we do need that space to, as you said, let things go temporarily and just let it be. I'll give you an example. For example, when I work on a big project like my books, I have got to let them rest for a few months after I finish. And then I need to go back and look at them changed. I have changed and they have changed. We've both gelled, right?
I'm a songwriter and I understand that completely. You want to come back and hear it with ears again.
That's right. So what's that process like for you in the songwriting? I'm interested to hear.
Well, I would say it's very similar to how you described, because it first starts out like the brand new thing, you know, coming out of the air, and as you know, to know is associated sometimes with the element air, it's the newness, and it's like that. It's being created, it's being learned, you're beginning to know it, then it's fire, then you're just on, then you're just playing your guitar and trying to find it, you know, everything about it. It's really where you come in and you're willing it. And then, of course, the evening comes and things settle down a little bit, and now you're daring to put it out into the world, just as you said. And then I do want to walk away from it. So I would definitely say a lot of my songwriting goes through this process you mentioned, because I like to walk away from it for a while, then come back and hear it again with, like, kind of new ears.
But you're staying silent while you're hearing it again with new ears.
Right.
Like she said, because you had changed, and maybe there's something in it now that to criticize. So I would say it's very similar to that process, to be honest.
And it's very much the same as writing a study or a paper as well. Just that staying away from it for a while and coming back to make sure, you know, what you were thinking one day is not the same as next.
That's right. That's right. You know, the example I often like to use, too, is anyone who does a lot of divination work, you know, whether it's tarot or astrology or runes or just psychic readings, we all know that's a snapshot of a moment. And as soon as the person or ourselves moves and takes action, the future changes, right? And so the place of silence gives room for that change also, which I find really fascinating.
It is, and that's from the slow integrated wisdom, you know, like planting a seed, you know, that's why that's earth, you know, earth integration, you know, that's when they integrate, and that's when they, you know, begin to take life and weave in with the soil. And Brett, we'll let you take the next few questions. We have three hosts here on this show, so we're trying to organize this.
Okay,
go ahead, Brett.
Well, my area is going to be mostly on your other media exploits. You do a podcast.
I do.
I believe, Know Thyself. And it seems to be based around the elements, or at least each show seems to have an elemental type feel. How do you incorporate that? How does that work?
So elemental castings, I do cycle through the elements, and I have a different guest on every show. And what I do is I say, okay, say you are a healer. I might try to put you in on fire so we can talk about the importance of fire in the healing process. You know, and what does that look like, and what does that feel like, and how does that affect our magic, et cetera. And it's just a good structure and a jumping off point for deeper discussions rather than just having a musician or an author or a magic worker on to talk in general. I really appreciate the elemental focus because it draws things out that we might not otherwise get to. Like, I had a woman on, Miss Maya, who does a lot of work with her hoodoo practice, and we were able to talk about the power of water and divination, but also things like sacred baths. So it just opens things up in a way that's interesting to me. To tell you the truth, though, that podcast has been winding down, and I have recently replaced it with a new project called Make Magic of Your Life, which is a YouTube webcast that I'm doing twice a month.
So so that'll will it have a similar focus, or do you have new plans for that? Because it is video
that,
as well.
That one, so the podcast I could do longer format because it's easier for people to just listen to audio for longer. But since this is video, I'm keeping them really brief. I'm trying to keep them under 15 minutes. And we're cycling through the four powers. We're cycling through knowing, willing, daring, and silence. And so far I've done five and had really different people on every time, and it's been quite interesting so far. I've had writers and activists and other people on. I've got a hip-hop artist coming up, a fiction writer, and it's really fun. And it's a little more challenging to keep things under 15 minutes, but I appreciate having to hone things down.
Yeah, it is generally harder to have something when you have to show restraint when you have less time, and you have to have more oomph in those 15 minutes than you do in the 60 minutes or however long a podcast episode was.
Right.
You've also done music. As Daniel mentioned, you know, we have sounders, we love musicians. So what kind of music projects have you done?
I've done a lot over the years. I did a couple of self-produced CDs that were folk rock. The first one a little more folk, the second one a little more rock, Give Us a Kiss. They're both out of print physically, but they can be found digitally on my Bandcamp page if you go to Thorn Coil at Bandcamp. But I've also done more recently two chant CDs with musician Sharon Knight, who's just a wonderful, talented woman. And we collaborated on Songs for the Waning Year and Songs for the Strengthening Sun. So it's music for the darker part of the year and music for the lighter part of the year. And hopefully we'll be working on a new CD together starting in August. So it's all music. It's all music that is devotional music. It's spiritual music. It's magical music.
I hope that goes well. Yeah, I got to get copies of some of those because North, the lighter half of the year and the darker half of the year, really could use some devotional work for those times.
Yeah.
It's just the whole year, it's like specifically for that, because you see a lot of music, you know, especially in the pagan world, that's about a specific goddess or a specific time, but not for, or a season, but not for the entire half of the year.
Yeah. It was really nice working on those two CDs. We had a lot of great musicians come into the studio to work on that with us. It was quite a collaborative process. And I feel like Sharon's style and my style blend really nicely together, and it created a synergy that I think really comes forward. We've had a great response to those CDs.
A lot of times you notice a lot of pagan musicians have a more, like that are in Wicca, seem to have a more folkish type feel to their music.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also noticed that a lot of Norse seem to have a lot of metal typing. Do you think your tradition has shaped what kind of music that you've fallen into, or do you think those two are completely unrelated?
Well, I think that you're onto something. I think that pagan folk has been really active, and I think that heathen metal is also a driving force. I love heathen metal, actually. It's some of my favorite music to go see live. But for me personally, it's just been my own personal evolution. You know, I used to listen to more folk music, and now I listen to a lot less folk music, and I listen to more metal, or I listen to more, not exactly techno, but industrial music. And so that influences me more now. And Sharon Knight, who's my current collaborator, she actually splits her time between folk and metal. It's very interesting that you chose those two. Her work really combines the two. And some of her projects are a little more folk and Celtic oriented, and some are a little more metal and rock oriented. So yeah, I do think people's traditions shape their music and shape the music that they're drawn to, but I also think that some of us cross over quite a bit.
Oh yeah, my taste is across the board. I mean, I have a certain type of music that I'm sort of better at playing. You know, I sound better sort of, you know, acoustic, you know, kind of folk rock kind of stuff. It's just what I'm, you know, it just feels at home to me. But my taste in music is completely, it's all over the place, you know, whether it's...
Mine too.
Reggae, or whether it's Janice hosts a reggae show, by the way, or whether it's you know, metal or electronic, or, you know, one of my very favorite musicians in the world is Tori Amos. I just think she's a great songwriter.
You know, twice. She's cool.
So my taste is all over the place, really. You know, so.
Thank you.
And right now, I also wanted to get into something. Let's go back into the past a little bit, and then Janice is going to have a question later about something you recently wrote. Right now, I want to go back into the past a little bit, in that you are someone with a training lineage. It's pretty interesting, and that's what I wanted to ask you about, and that's coming from Victor and Cora Anderson. We're talking pre-Gardnerian, Gideon Pendarwin, Starhawk, all of them in the same teacher and student like lineage, the fairy tradition. I wonder if you could explain that relationship, how you all met, how this happened.
Sure. I was introduced to fairy tradition, the Anderson fairy tradition, when I first moved to San Francisco when I was 18. I had already been studying the craft before that. And fairy tradition just felt resonant. It felt powerful and really potent to me. So I studied for a while with one teacher, but I didn't end up meeting Victor and Cora for several years until I was working with a coven and we wanted more training. And so we sought them out and we actually met with them a couple of times. And the way I described meeting Victor and Cora, I said it was like going to your grandparents' house. By the end of the visit, you were knocked to the floor. It was really funny. Like, we would leave their house stunned and go get margaritas because...
Right, you had to, like, calm, ground yourself a little bit.
And it was, you know, it was like slamming down all the psychic centers that had opened wide from being with the two of them. And, you know, it's not what I recommend for people. I'm like, here, let's actually do these spiritual practices instead of just slamming tequila.
Right.
It's more sustainable. But they were that powerful. And, you know, Victor would sit and rock in his chair and tell stories. And he was such a shapeshifter. Whatever culture he was telling the story from, it was as though he looked as if he were from that culture. He would literally change.
Ooh.
And of course,
I wish I could see that.
For those that don't know,
yeah.
Victor Anderson You know, because a lot of people, and rightfully so, you know, Gerald Gardner brought a lot to, you know, modern witchcraft, Wicca, all those things. We're talking in the 50s. Victor Anderson was someone known to be in covens and had some works out in poetry and other things, but we're talking 1920s, about 1926,
yeah.
I think, you know. So this is quite a few years before the whole Gardnerian thing kicked in. No disrespect to Gerald Gardner, I'm just saying, but
right.
And it was a man kind of uniquely American. You know, he was an American form of witchcraft.
It is very American. He was with the Harpy Coven in Oregon in the 1930s. And he also had stories about growing up in New Mexico and studying with some of the, you know, Latin American craft traditions in New Mexico. And then Cora is very interesting. She was raised in the poor Irish mining towns in Appalachia.
Okay.
And her grandfather was an herb doctor who would travel around from these, you know, little poor, dirt poor towns on his horse, healing
that is
people.
Awesome.
He was the only doctor they had.
Wise man.
And Cora literally had an evil stepmother. And she would be locked out of the house a lot of the time and would just spend most of her time in the woods and developed a relationship with nature and with the fairies. She had fairy friends. There's a great story she told us that a fairy came to her in a dream and said, "You've been a really good girl, and look at this rock on your way to school, and there'll be a present for you." And so Cora the next day was walking to school and looked under the rock, and sure enough, there was a nickel, which in those days bought a lot of candy.
Oh, yeah, that was something then.
You know.
And the story goes that she and Victor actually met on the astral, and she met Victor when she was very young on the astral years before they met in person. And once they met in person, they recognized each other. So the magical lineage really came through both of them in very different ways. And Cora really was a kitchen witch. She did healing magic through cooking. She cooked in a hospital, and the patients would always say they knew when she wasn't in the kitchen because the food didn't taste as good, right? So she would do that kind of magic, herb magic, sweeping magic, kitchen magic. And Victor did a lot more on the astral, and he brought through a lot of more esoteric work because he went mostly blind as a small child. And so I think that facilitated his ability to walk between the worlds. And so here's Cora with this really ultra-practical household magic, and then Victor with the more esoteric astral work. And together they blended a really amazing, beautiful, as you said, American homegrown magical tradition that, of course, over time ended up taking on influences from various places, including Wicca, as that information became more known here. But so I would just feel incredibly fortunate to have studied at all with them. It was a blessing. That's what I can say about that.
Mm.
I've just talked a lot. Do you have more questions about that?
Oh no, it's quite all right. Hey, that's
yes.
These people know what I sound like. You're the guest.
Yes, they know. They know our voices.
All right. Well, let's go to something modern now, because Denise wanted to ask you about something you had written recently. And we're definitely shifting gears here, but since it's going so well, I think it's a good idea right now.
Okay. Well, I had two questions, but I think the second question is a little bit more pressing than the first question. We all know what happened with the trial of Trayvon Martin, and I don't want to get into that because I'm very emotional about it. Because I'm a black woman, and Trayvon was a black teenager, child, man. But I did read this morning, Confronting Racism is Spiritual Work. And I do agree with you very much that racism is a disease that we need to actually deal with on many different levels, and spiritually is one of the levels that we need to deal with it. So I wanted to have your thoughts about working against racism and that being part of spiritual work for not only you, but for myself and other people out there.
Yeah, so my blog post, Confronting Racism and Spiritual Work, is actually one in a long series of posts I've written about social injustice in the U.S. and how it affects me as a magic worker, as a spiritual person, and just as a human. I've worked off and on with local families in Oakland, California, whose sons have been killed by police. I feel like there's almost an epidemic of young black men being killed by forces of whether it's police or security forces. There's a recent study that came out that says every 36 hours, an African-American man is killed by police or security forces. That's a problem.
I think it's more than every 24, but that's just my personal belief.
Yeah, and, you know, these families that I've been attempting to help, which can feel very frustrating to me because I feel like I'm not very effective, mostly they're people who were killed for really no reason other than they were black.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think is important to realize is that we need to get away from thinking of people as being a racist, right? And we need to look at the fact that we live in interlocking systems of racism, right? That there's systemic racism, and it's the water we swim in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates a whole cascade of things. You know, it's what started off the George Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin case, right?
Right.
Why in our culture are non-black people trained to be fearful of black people, right? And it goes all the way back to the systems of control of brutal chattel slavery that we still are not over. And we think we're over, and we want to say we're post-racial, and we're not, right? So I could go on and on about this, and I really encourage people to try to do some research about educating ourselves about systemic racism, about aversive racism, which is what I sometimes just call casual racism. It's not that angry, ugly bigotry. It's just unconsciousness, callousness, myopia. And if we educate ourselves on that and on privilege, already we're helping the conversation. But I want to get back to your question about it being a spiritual matter. When I look at my spiritual work and my work on self, I need to look at all the parts of myself that I want to avoid. I want to look at the parts of myself that make me feel uncomfortable, the parts I would rather would just go away. And I need to find ways to be in relationship to them and to bring them back into the embrace of the whole. It is our job to repair the world in Kabbalistic terms. Or one thing I always like to think of is the story of Isis and Osiris. You know, that
my favorite
Isis
story.
She had to literally remember Osiris. She had to put back together his scattered parts. And she had to literally fashion the part that was the life giver, right? We have to do that with ourselves personally. We have to heal ourselves and become whole physically, spiritually, emotionally, energetically, and mentally. And that cascades out into our culture. We do that work on self, and simultaneously we say, what do I need to pay attention to better heal my community, to be in right relationship with my friends and my loved ones? Right? I can't just stop with my healing. That healing needs to ripple out. And remember, just as I talked about the four powers, if we start with just a little bit, then we build. It's the same with healing work. I don't have to wait until I feel all fully integrated and healed before then I start to do service work or justice work. No, I start where I am and I say, what internal resources do I have now to try to educate myself, to be of greater service, to try to heal my communities, to have these difficult conversations, right? We all have some capacity. So what's my capacity today? And how do I look at the ways in which my community is avoiding these conversations? How do I look at the very real pain that is happening in the world every day? And how do I address that pain from a place of compassion, connection, strength, and love? And all of our spiritual practices help us to do that, right?
Yes. I would like to add, as someone who has, I'll bring up the trial for just a second. I avoid sensationalized trials like the plague, but mm-hmm. I confront the reactions.
Mm-hmm.
I have to work with the reactions from both sides, and I want to say to everyone that healing is required because you can be on either side for the wrong reasons.
That's right.
It doesn't matter what your feelings of the case, make sure it's for the right reasons.
Yes.
Right.
So,
does the healing come in no matter what our emotional states are and what our thoughts are?
Right. And we are, you know, both sides are hurting for reasons. There's, I will say this plainly, there's the end result, whatever your feelings of the case are, there is someone who is dead, and there is a family grieving, and we must remember that.
Right.
There was a lot of money spent on this trial. A lot of it is, you know, partially ours. Where could that money have gone that would have done better for everyone else? We need to look at all sides of this issue, not just a verdict.
Which is
yes,
why
we do
I
need to look at all sides of this issue because it's not just black men. Because I know I was at my part-time job last night, and these people that I've been pretty much with for almost a year or two, and I was sitting there waiting for David to come and pick me up. And I sat down, and this white woman who is like my boss, well, she's part of the establishment, and I'm in a restaurant. I'm a host for the restaurant, and she moved her tips over to the right, away from me. Now, most people would have never caught that, and if I was actually talking to somebody else, I probably would have missed it myself. But the mere fact that she had to move her tips away from me for somebody who's already worked there for almost a year, and I think if I was going to be a criminal, which I'm not, I think if I wanted to take her tips, I would have taken it a long time ago. I want to wait for my anniversary to be, oh, okay, I'm going to take her tips now. So,
yeah.
And it's that subtlety that most people miss.
Insensitivity. They don't understand what they're doing. Even if they're not people that truly hate, they don't understand the residual, like, insensitivity, I think. That's, it's just in that for them to work on,
right.
You know what I mean? And I don't think people are
able to. Many of them probably don't even realize they're doing it. And that's the worst thing of all is they don't realize it.
That's
you know?
I don't know. And she just... No, because I brought it up to her attention. It's like, well, you know, you didn't have to move your tips away from me. I already saw your tips. So it's, you know, I don't want your tips. I have my own tips. Thank you very much. But she still thought that, and it could be something ingrained that she didn't realize what she was doing, but I came close to her money and she reacted.
Exactly.
It's why I find it helpful to look at the systems that need healing, right? And
mm-hmm.
I think you're right, whoever said that it's often just unconscious It is unconscious. And so can we bring that to light? You know, part of our ability as magic workers is shining light into the dark spaces and saying, what's here, right? We're trained as magic workers that we don't have to be afraid of the dark. We can walk in the dark, and we can build relationship with that. And, you know, we can bring things that are in the subconscious up and say, let's look at this. Let's not be so frightened of it. Let's talk about this. You know, as witches, as magicians, as whatever we call ourselves, it's part of our role in the community to ask the uncomfortable questions that can bring us to greater states of healing and integration. I really think that's part of our job. And we all can do it in very different ways. You know, I have a more public platform that I use. But each of us, maybe we just do it by how we treat someone at the grocery store or you having the conversation with this woman at work, right? We can do our magic anywhere, and we can be priests and priestesses anywhere. And that's our call, I think. And the more we really take on that responsibility, the greater our ability becomes to repair the world, to bring the shards back towards wholeness, to remember Osiris.
Well, you know, Isis had to remember him twice, though. So, I'm an Isian, so I know about Isis.
It's ongoing work. And we have to do it over and over, right? Because everything's in a cycle. Everything's in process, as I said earlier. Was there anything else on that anyone had to say?
Anything else you want to say on that?
Well, one thing I would like to say is that the superiority complex that can exist, or the insensitivity complex, like we said, even if it's unconscious, some of that also comes from being misinformed. People are trained in certain ways. I'll give you a good example about how things are not as different as people think. And I'm going to clarify that in just a second. Because one of my things I say all the time is that there's a illusion of separation, and that human beings are basically, everything's connected. I work with a lot of African Americans. I do electrical work as part of one of the things I do for a living. And on construction sites, you know, around in this part of the country, it's mostly black and Latino. I'm actually very often dramatically the minority on the job, being the Caucasian. And I also work with a lot of islanders, Jamaican, you know, Barbados and stuff like that. And they'll tell you, you know, Jamaican slave trade history, before the English abolished it, you go into their museums, and there's white and Chinese slaves. And there's a lot of people that are white in Jamaica. There are a lot of people that are born long-time family, native Chinese Jamaicans. So this idea, this fake superiority, I know we're taking this in sort of a little bit white supremacy here, but this was just greedy people taking advantage of whoever they could take advantage of, you know. And if you were white and you were in a weird position, slightly different kind of slavery, but you were still a slave, and you were traded, and you were dropped off at the middle point in Jamaica, and if maybe you got sent somewhere, maybe you stayed.
A lot of Irish actually end up in Jamaica, too. And
some people from India and other places.
Interracial breeding, I hate to say it that way, but it was a lot of Irish blood mixed with Jamaican blood
ends up being with the lighter skinned blacks, and you know, I could do a whole show on that, but I won't. But you know, it was the integration of that, huh?
That's another day,
yes. So
anyway, what I'm talking about is, if you think you are one of these people that feels so superior, if you didn't have the money, you're not. It was about, where if you were poor, you might have been like, you know, all right, sir, I'll come onto your ranch. You'll give me a place to stay. I mean, whatever. I mean, it's different countries, different things. But don't think you're all that superior because of what you looked like how you were born. If you go to other places and see that slave trade travel history and things like that, it becomes an eye-opener for many people, I think.
Well, and so to bring us back, then, I think that's a really good point. What does connect us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's the flow of God herself, right? That's the flow of Goddess. Everything, flow of love moves through us all, and we are all part of that fabric. And so how are we taking responsibility to weave our particular color and texture into the fabric of the cosmos, right? Or how are we snarling that up and making knots or trying to separate our threads out? And one thing I often say is that, you know, we are part of this non-dual flow. We are part of the flow of everything. And yet, duality comes in to teach us, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we look at day and night. We look at hot and cold. We look at up and down. We look at love and fear. And on one hand, they're all the same because they're all part of the flow. But the making those distinctions are helpful teachers to us. And again, it's our job to, like the High Priestess card in the Tarot, we stand between those two pillars that look and feel so different, the pillar of mercy and the pillar of severity. But it's our job to mediate between the two of them and to align ourselves between them and to hold them both and say, these are reconciled in me, right? That's another part of the healing process, is to bring those polarities that seem so distinct back into union and say, here, feel the embrace of love. That is some powerful magic, and that's a spiritual act. It takes a lot of training and a lot of consciousness and a lot of fortitude. It's not easy work, but again, all the basic practices in every spiritual tradition, in every magical tradition, can train us towards that strength and resiliency and can train us towards the capacity to hold polarity and to mediate that middle pillar and to reconcile differences. And wow, if I can start to do that within myself, then I can train myself to better do that in my community. And that's how we change the world.
Well, that's a very long process that a lot of people have to get on board with. Yes. We have a long way to go. I know that's been said in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and now in the 2000s, but we still have a very long way to go.
And I think the first thing is, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, my parents' generation, my parents are 50s generation, I love them, you know, my parents, all that, but we don't see eye to eye on anything. And but that generation was like, they did not look internally. Now, my parents weren't particularly hateful. Like, I was raised not to say the N-word, things like that. But they still had lots of their residual stuff. You know what I mean? But they weren't outwardly, you know, they were, and they raised us not to be that way. They raised us not to be, oh, don't, you know, don't dislike this person because of how they look. But they had the stuff that was still hammered in their head. But they did not, that generation was not known for its inner searching. I mean, certain branches of it were not. It has to start with you looking within and going, okay, what about this? What if I wake up differently? What if I was in that situation? All those sorts of things, you know.
Right. Right.
And so we're coming down now. I just want to let everybody know what's going on here. We're down now to about 6 minutes on the clock. Man, the time flew by.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It does sometimes when you start talking and when the mind starts working. And some of the topics we talked about, we could turn into five-hour shows. Somebody might write I wanted to ask you something because I saw it in your bio, and now we're going to drift away from this topic a little bit, but it's related because it's social justice related. That's kind of big for me because I live in a house with not one, but two Unitarian ministers. And I saw that you worked with Unitarians before in the past in your bio. And, in fact, I was curious because you mentioned a place in D.C. I'm curious if you know my brother. His name is the Reverend Scott Samuel Michael.
No.
don't recognize the name. Just curious, I'd throw that out there. And Reverend Anya Samore Michael, his wife, is over in Sterling, Virginia. Scott is at Acatink. And sometimes they hear the archives of these shows because sometimes we bring up a related topic. But I was thinking of asking you about your relationship with the Unitarian Church and some of your any interesting story that sticks right up out at you about speaking at, I saw you speak at Catholic churches and anything else. Any reactions from the interfaith stuff is what I'm trying to get down to. Do you ever get any strange or odd reactions from a place that was maybe, you know, not as accepting of a pagan or something like that, or very positive?
What I've mostly found in my interfaith work, I've done a lot of interfaith work, including presenting at the Parliament of the World's Religions when it was in Melbourne, Australia. And I've spoken at Unitarian churches and Catholic churches, but mostly my interfaith work is done through social justice work. And what I have found is that the people I do my justice work with, we always find the common ground. What's most important for us is how spirit works in matter, you know? What is justice, whether it's environmental justice, social justice, racial and economic justice, right? I've always found people to be warm and welcoming and really curious and interested to find what I bring as a pagan to our justice work. And I really haven't had any bad experiences in my interfaith work at all. If anything, people are curious and sometimes want me to speak to things, you know, as a pagan, that I'm like, well, anyone could speak to this, whether you're Christian, Muslim, atheist, it doesn't matter. But I find that the common ground and the wish for a better world unites us all. And people who are doing justice work, I think, mostly are looking for connection. I think we're all deeply aware of the patterns of disconnection that we've built in our societies. And any way that we can find to come together and hold hands, people feel pretty willing to do that. So I found that people are interested in focusing on what unites us rather than on the divisions, because the divisions have caused great wounding. And we're trying to heal those wounds.
All right. Well, we're pretty much coming down to it, folks. Brett, did you have any last comments?
I did want to say, like, on the interfaith thing. Now, I am getting ready to move into an Episcopal priesthood study, possibly. I mean, there's a lot of back and forth in that. And I just want to say, you know, in that capacity, I would think it would be wrong to not to want to have interfaith talks, mm-hmm. and especially in the realm of justice, because it's something that really, you know, unites us all, that we want the world to be better, especially, you know, country, world, whatever. Our justice system is skewed because we are skewed in a lot of our own precepts.
Right.
Human system.
And I mean, look who I work with on this show. Most people would not expect to hear me say that based on, you know, what show I do, you know. So interfaith is important.
Mm-hmm.
Well, T. Thorne, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. We're coming to the
I want to thank you, too.
Coming up to
thank
the end
you.
Of the hour here. And we'll go ahead and post, like, your website and stuff on the archives. A lot of times we get a lot more listens on the archives. We had an okay chat room tonight, so thank you very much.
Thank you all so much, and may our work be blessed, and may our work be a blessing.
All right. Thank you. And it was a blessing to have such a pleasant guest.
Yes, it was a blessing.
I felt like we could have talked for another 3 hours.
Could actually.
All right. Well, good night, everyone, and you're listening to Main Street Universe. Remember, you can go back in the archive, Super Time Machine, and listen to them again. Thank you.
Forbidden archaeology, forgotten history, divination, magic, cryptozoology, UFOs, nature, science, and spirit. All this and more right here on the Main Street Universe Radio Network.